It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
It's just as well Dr. Harold Shipman is dead, or he'd be sitting along 50 metres from me on the benches of the Parliamentary Labour Party, following the defection of the most right-wing savage reactionary in the entire House to the Labour ranks today. She crossed the floor to consternation from some, but an ecstatic welcome from most of her parliamentary colleagues. And a Palestinian woman says, "Yesterday, my little boy was dancing joyously in the street as the news of a truce came through. Today, we buried him." The children crushed under the masonry of the latest unhinged assault by Netanyahu's gang of child killers are everywhere on our telephones and our social media, nowhere in the so-called mainstream media or in the minds of the politicians who rule us. And what next for Ukraine as the Russian forces begin to carry all before them? How long will Zelensky last beyond the 20th of May, which is when his presidency ends? It's all coming up this evening on the mother of all talk shows. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Mrs. Natalie Elphick was suspended from the House of Commons for seeking to influence a judge presiding over the case of her husband, the then MP for Dover. He was standing trial for rape and sexual assault. She blamed the women, saying that her attractive spouse was always getting too much attention from young women like the victims of her husband's sex-crazed crimes. She was admitted to the ranks of the Parliamentary Labour Party today. Mrs. Natalie Elphick blamed the firefighters for the deaths of three people in her constituency and demanded that they be stripped of their right to strike. Mrs. Natalie Elphick, Labour Member of Parliament, is fond of standing on the beaches and screaming abuse at the desperate people who've made it across the English Channel. Today, she's a Labour Member of Parliament. Not like Jeremy Corbyn. He's not good enough for the Labour Party, even though he led it in 2017 to its greatest electoral performance since 1945, when Keir Starmer was in his shadow cabinet and describing him as his friend. Mrs. Elphick is a Labour MP, but Diane Abbott is not. She remains suspended 1 year on, pending investigation of a letter that she wrote to a national newspaper, namely The Observer. In the letter, she said something that almost everyone would agree was an obvious statement of truth. But 12 months later, she remains suspended. So there's no room at the inn for Diane Abbott, who entered Parliament on the same day as me, nearly 40 years ago. There's no room for Jeremy Corbyn, the former leader of the Labour Party. But a woman who could quite comfortably have fitted in under the flag of the British National Party, a far-right Conservative, crossed the floor to almost universal aplomb in the House of Commons today. If ever there was evidence supplied that the Uni Party is one, that so little distance is there not even a narrow tributary, never mind a political river. No red water, no blue water between the two cheeks of the same backside. This was the evidence. There's no room for socialists in the Labour Party, but neo-fascists can apply. Mrs. Elphick is one. She is now sitting behind the presumed next Prime Minister of Great Britain. It is a shameful day, a day which in normal times would see Keir Starmer's portrait turned to face the wall. But it will not be. The Labour Party is dead. It is a dead parrot. It is an ex-parrot. And those who remain in it, those Labour MPs, councillors, activists, office bearers, members, are really now beyond hope. There can be no redemption for them. And so I am bound to announce that we will not take any more defections from the Labour Party after the end of this month. We're giving people to the end of this month to leave the genocidal Labour Party of Keir Starmer and Natalie Elphick. Put the note in your diary now. The end of May is the end of us taking people who are prepared to, even at this 11th hour, defect and dissociate themselves from the genocide. Much more importantly, a Palestinian woman wrote today that the day before she saw her son dancing joyously in the ravaged streets of Rafah. Dancing because the news had broken on Radio Monte Carlo in Arabic that the Palestinian resistance had accepted the ceasefire terms which the whole world was demanding that they accept. The children thought that the days and nights of endless torture, murder, of the blood running freely in the filthy, sewage-strewn streets of Rafah would soon be over. Imagine that woman's grief as she buried that same little boy in the foul earth of contaminated Gaza today. The pictures of children crushed under breeze block have touched many millions of people around the world. For some, it's no longer possible to look at the suffering, the misery, the death, the destruction, the famine, the disease that is rampant in a cage, a concentration camp of 2.3 million people, 1.6 million of them now trapped in the tent city of Rafah alongside the Egyptian frontier. Israel didn't just reject the ceasefire that the Palestinians accepted. It doubled down. It crossed all the red lines that all the Western leaders had tried to lead us to believe they had drawn. If the Israeli army invades Rafah, they said, it would be impossible to avoid committing serious crimes against humanity. It would thereby inevitably lead to the issuing of warrants for the arrest of Israeli leaders. It would make it implicitly impossible for Western countries to continue to supply the weapons, the money, the material, and the diplomatic and political cover which has facilitated, enabled, collaborated with 7 months of genocidal violence. In the House of Commons yesterday, I spoke again about this matter. The Zionist lobby was out in force, particularly in the rancid form of one Suella Braverman. It was the first time I had watched her up close and personal. She's not as nice as she looks. And she looks exactly what she is, pure, unadulterated evil. I'm saying this here now in the building. I could not say it in the chamber. There I have to pretend that she is a right honourable lady. But in fact, she came to the House yesterday to demand that Netanyahu be backed by the British government to finish the job. By finish the job, she meant the crushing underfoot, under blocks, under bricks, under fire of little children and women. She talked about the Israeli hostages and demanded proof of life of those hostages. Actually, Israel has killed a very significant number of those hostages. At this rate, there may be no live hostages left to exchange with the much larger number, exponentially larger number, of Palestinian hostages held without trial in Israeli dungeons. Braverman demanded that the hostages be freed and that proof of life be provided. I countered that there was no proof of life of the 66,000 children, hostages, in the tent city of Rafah. Uncountable numbers of those children and their mothers are now either murdered, maimed, or living in terror of being murdered and maimed. These children and their mothers and their fathers, brothers, and sisters are every bit as much a hostage as any Israeli prisoner taken on the 7th of October. The difference is the Palestinians, for their own reasons, perhaps, are desperately trying to keep them alive. The child hostages in Rafah are, on the other hand, the subject of remorseless and desperate attacks by the Israeli government to kill them. Kill a large number of them, they already have, and they will not stop killing until they are stopped. As I said in the show on Sunday, Israel is the worst serial killer in history. They have killed more women and children than every murderer, every mass murderer of whom you have ever heard. All the documentaries you've ever watched on Netflix about these mass killers pale into insignificance compared to Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and the rest of his murderous cutthroat gang. But the problem is, those watching this show have almost certainly seen the images to which I am referring. The mass of the population, unfortunately, have seen none of them. The mass of the population don't know that while there's 123 or so Israeli hostages, that there are some 10,000 Palestinian hostages, including people that were freed during the last exchange of hostages, only promptly to be dragged back behind bars. These Palestinian hostages have never been tried. Insofar as they are ever tried, they are tried under the mandate laws left by the British mandate in 1948. They are tried in front of military judges in military courts, but most of them are never tried at all. The people who know about those who died, were killed on October the 7th, most of the people that are not watching this show have no idea that something like now 150,000 Palestinians have been killed, mutilated, maimed, wounded, with no hospitals to look after them, or are still missing under the rubble. 150,000 out of a population of 2.3 million. Most people don't know that the people of Gaza literally have nowhere to go. They are trapped on all sides. Even walking into the sea would bring about their demise by the guns of the Israeli Navy lying just offshore. This is not shooting fish in a barrel. This is murdering children in a barrel. It's murdering women in a barrel. This is a slaughter, an annihilation, an attempt to literally annihilate, to extirpate, to completely wipe out an entire genus of people, hence the crime of genocide. This is an attempt to clear the land. No more, no less. It's not about religion. It's not about people claiming to feel unsafe on the campus of the London School of Economics or the School of Oriental and African Studies or in Columbia or Yale or Harvard or UCLA. This is not about anti-Semitism. This is about an attempt by a terrorist state literally to clear a piece of land of its inhabitants, either by driving them out into the Sinai Desert in some biblical exodus, which is why Israel has now taken control of the Egyptian frontier itself in total violation of the Camp David Accords of 1979, an act of war against the Quisling regime of General Sisi in Egypt, although he has said nothing so far about this act of war, about this breach of Egypt's sovereignty. Egypt, the beating heart of the Arab world, 120 million people, whose gallant army in 1973 liberated the Suez Canal, liberated the Sinai, drove the Israelis out of their land, is now being utterly humiliated by Netanyahu. This poses a problem for President Biden because both Israel and Egypt are his close friends. Both Israel and Egypt are dumps for untold billions of American taxpayers' money. And now one is committing acts of war against the other. It is a sorry mess, but even worse is the mess in Western parliaments, governments, chanceries, presidential palaces, prime ministers' residences. These Western politicians appear not to know what to do. They all drew a red line. Their red line has now been crossed. They cannot bring themselves. In the case of the British, I tried to intervene on the Prime Minister today. I was not successful in being called. If I had been, I was going to ask him why he ordered our brave pilots flying out of Akrotiri in our sovereign base in somebody else's Cyprus to fly spy missions, 200 spy missions over the Gaza Strip, in fortification of Netanyahu's genocidal assault. I was not able to ask the question, but I can tell you already what his answer would have been. It would have been that we never comment on the movements of our military forces, which isn't actually true, but would have sufficed as an attempt to palm off that question. We are flying spy flights over Gaza, 200 of them, to facilitate the crushing and shredding, the murdering and mutilating of little children and women. And the British Parliament is not even entitled to an answer to the question, why? He said today that the amount of arms being exported from Britain to Israel was minuscule. Well, minuscule or not, those arms are killing children and women. But that's only minuscule if you define it as a completed weapon. The truth is, materiel from here in Britain is in almost all Israeli munitions. Parts of Israeli weapons are exported from here on an almost daily basis. And so, having authored the entire Palestinian disaster in this building, in the Balfour Declaration of 1917, when on behalf of one people, our government promised to a second people the land that belonged to a third people, sending us, in Churchill's words, down that dreadful, blood-stained staircase to where we are now in 2024, we're still at it. Britain is still killing Palestinians. Well, on this day in 1945, in the next hours, in Moscow, they will be celebrating mightily Victory Day. It won't be marked here. In fact, it was marked here in Britain today by the Home Secretary announcing a new raft of punishments and sanctions on Russia on the basis that the last raft did so well, succeeded so almost completely, that Russia is booming while Britain and the West is sinking, that the Russian economy is powering ahead as ours falters and dies. We won't mention Victory Day because we don't want to remember the glorious wartime alliance of the USA, Great Britain, China, and the USSR. We can't mention it, even though on this day, the Beast of Berlin was crushed in his lair by the victorious Red Army, with the British and American armies on the Elbe. We can't mention it, because now we have to love Germany and hate Russia. We have to love Japan and hate China. That's the moral and political bankruptcy of Western governments, I hope summed up well in a 20-minute monologue. Stay tuned for Scott Ritter, the world's leading analyst of war and the politics of war. Stay tuned.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Scott Ritter, I don't need to give an ample introduction. He needs none. He is, quite simply, now the preeminent analyst on the wars now raging. And we are lucky to have him every Wednesday evening on the Mother of All Talk Shows for this war report. Scott, thank you very much for joining us. In my monologue, I don't know if you heard it, I dealt with the new situation which now exists in Gaza in breach of the Camp David Accords, the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, which forbid Israeli forces to be in what's known as the Philadelphia Corridor. And the Israeli forces are now on the Egyptian frontier and controlling the Egyptian-Gaza gate. Your thoughts, first of all, on the military-political implications of that?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely correct to point out that this is a violation of the Camp David Accords. In fact, Egypt, President Sisi has been saying that if Israel were to do this, that it would end the state of peace that exists. I think Israel's called Egypt's bluff, just like Israel has called everybody's bluff on this, on the issue of the Palestinian people and its ongoing oppression in Gaza. Sadly, I don't think Egypt's going to do what it is permitted to do, which is to declare war on Israel. Israel has committed an act of war. It's an open violation of the terms of peace peace should no longer exist between Egypt and Israel. And yet it does. Israel has been able to get away with literal murder in Gaza. The genocidal behavior of the Israeli troops is well documented. It's not even up for debate. And yet the world continues to treat Israel as a legitimate actor on the international stage. And, you know, right now, Egypt is looking impotent, literally a powerless nation that joins.
I mean, it's a beggar. It's a beggar state, and it breaks my heart to describe the country of Gamal Abdel Nasser in those words. 120 million Egyptians, the beating heart of the Arab world, but it's a beggar. And Israel knows that. But what about the United States, Scott? They are the guarantors of the Camp David Accords. They're called the Camp David Accords for a reason. Can't the United States government draw their attention to the fact that a vital component of those accords signed at Camp David all those years ago has now been broken by Israel? Or will that just be brushed aside?
Sadly, the United States is a beggar nation, too, when it comes to morality. We may be rich in purely commercial sense, but when it comes to that which defines a people, the conscience of a nation, we are a beggar nation. And it's proven as we speak by the fact that the United States has not taken decisive action against Israel. If we are ever to be trusted on the international stage again, and after what has been going on with Israel on Gaza, I would not advocate for trusting the United States as a partner in peace. But if we are to be trusted, we have to stand up for what we commit to. And we have committed as the guarantor, as you said, of this Camp David peace accord, of this peace agreement between Israel and Egypt. And what we're doing now by allowing Israel to get away again with literal murder. This isn't just tanks moving in. They are killing Palestinian civilians as we speak. Now, the United States, of course, will say, well, we just halted the shipment of bombs. That's a meaningless gesture, to be honest. Israel has plenty of bombs that we've already given them. And Israel knows that at some point in the near future, the shipment will resume because the United States cannot say no to Israel for any sustained period of time. And so Israel will just wait out America like they wait out Egypt, like they wait out the world, knowing that there will be no repercussions for this. And America has disgraced itself. It has shown that it cannot be a meaningful partner for peace in any agreement that is, you know, where the words have to carry weight. We have shown that when we promise that we will do something, we won't do it, especially when it comes to the state of Israel.
Let me ask you some, as it were, plain man's questions, which come into me as we speak, every time we speak. How about this one? As the fighters are presumably in tunnels, why does Israel drop white phosphorus on tents full of civilian families? I mean, what's the military purpose of that, Scott?
Well, unfortunately, war is an extension of politics by other means, meaning that for every military action, there's a political purpose behind it. And for Israel, the political purpose of all their military action is genocide, is to remove the Palestinian people from Gaza. There can be no safe haven. There can be no place where Palestinian families are allowed to rest, where mothers can feed their children, where fathers can, you know, try to provide some sort of nurturing or you know, care for their families. The Israelis deliberately drove the Palestinian people from the north, from the center of Gaza, into Rafah, telling them to go there, dropping leaflets with maps saying, this will be your safe haven. And the Palestinian people have accumulated there. And now the Israelis drop the white phosphorus to burn out their tents to make the point that there is no safe haven. You must leave. And eventually the question is, leave to where? And what Israel is banking on is that it will confront the world with the choice. Either you let us kill all the Palestinians, and we are willing to kill them and able to kill them, or you evacuate them from Gaza, get them out of the Gazan territory. The choice is going to be left up to the world. And as we've seen with the United States and in Egypt, unwilling to confront Israel for the crimes they're committing in Rafah, the world doesn't seem to be willing to stand up for the Palestinian people in this regard.
And seizing the gate to Egypt, literally the frontier, makes that ethnic cleansing now even more likely and easy, isn't it? They have the gate, they can open it, and they can tell the Palestinians if they want to avoid being killed, they better run before the gate closes. That might be the next step, Scott.
Well, I think it is, except I don't think the Israelis will tell the Palestinians anything. They will herd them like sheep to the slaughter. And, you know, again, the conversation that Israel can have with the Palestinian people can't be, in-depth or meaningful when you drop white phosphorus on tents containing sleeping families, when you have snipers who shoot mothers holding the hands of their little children while they're waving white flags, while you have sent tanks in to murder young Palestinian girls like Hind Rajab, the six-year-old girl that was slaughtered by Israeli tankers. This isn't the language of Israel is fear, intimidation based upon butchery and slaughter. I don't think they're going to be telling the Palestinians, they're going to be giving them no option. They will be driving them using tanks, artillery, aircraft, and they will open the gate and the Palestinians will only have one choice, flee or die.
And that will just move the Palestinian refugee problem from Gaza to the Sinai, where there will be nowhere to live, no water, no sewage, no hospitals, nothing to sustain 2.3 million people if they all end up there. Talk about kicking the can down the road, Scott. They're kicking a human can of enormous magnitude into somebody else's country and asking the rest of the world to sort it out. Isn't that right?
It is, with one minor exception. You said kicking a human can. From the Israeli perspective, they're kicking human animals. They're moving the Palestinians as if you would a flock of sheep or herd of cattle. They don't treat them as human beings. They don't care for them as human beings. Just like a cruel farmer or herdsman will stand by while a herd dies during drought with no water, no care. The Israelis don't view the Palestinians as human beings. And frankly speaking, and again, I don't like to say this, but I will, the Egyptians are the same. Anybody who stands by idly, the United States is the same. We are all treating the Palestinians as if they are human animals. These aren't human beings. These aren't people deserving of human rights. This is animal, cattle, sheep to be herded and to be executed, to be left to die if necessary. But, you know, I don't know how human beings can allow this to happen to other human beings in broad daylight. I mean, this is not something happening in the shadows. An iron curtain is not dropped around Israel where crimes can be committed without anybody seeing. This is happening right before the entire world. We are witness to this in real time. What are we doing to stop it? And the answer is, sadly, not a damn thing.
Well, look, we've only got time for a few minutes to discuss the parade in Moscow starting in a few hours' time, Moscow time, which recalls another era, another age, almost another world, Scott, where Victory Day, 1945, when the great wartime alliance of the United States, Great Britain, China, and the Soviet Union defeated fascism, crushed the beast in his Berlin lair. It's almost in my lifetime, 9 years before I was born. And yet the world situation we have today is so totally unrecognizable from that. It's hard to believe that it has all happened. As I said earlier, now we are supposed to hate Russia and love Germany, hate China and love Japan, even though we fought to the deaths of millions of people. We fought these adversaries in almost my own lifetime, and definitely in the lifetime of some of the people watching this.
Look, last year I had the honor and privilege of being in Moscow during Victory Day and to witness the parade firsthand. It's been described by Western commentators, by Western politicians, as a propaganda event, an empty gesture designed to appease the narcissistic, life of Vladimir Putin and his corrupt political elite. I can state with absolute certainty that it is not a propaganda event, not the way the Russians view it. It is an event that resonates with the very soul of the Russian people, because unlike their Western counterparts, they live the history of their nation, and they know the sacrifices that were made to defeat Nazi Germany. They know and they respect the alliances that they had. Last year, one thing that was apparent was that despite the fact that the United States, Great Britain, France, and the rest of Europe have done their best to forget the role Russia played in the decisive role Russia played in the Soviet Union played in defeating Nazi Germany, the Russians have never forgotten the role played by their allies, their one-time friends, and they continuously praise the sacrifice made by Americans, by the British, by the French, and others to overcome this enemy that is responsible for the deaths of 27 million Soviet citizens. So the hand of friendship is being extended by the Russians, but slapped away by the West. The difference between last year's parade and this year's parade, though, is that they have a president now who just was reelected, who is in the process of redefining Russia going forward. The Russia today is a far different place than the Russia of last year, because it's now united with a sense of patriotism, and it's looking forward to a world that where Russia no longer feels obliged to work with their former allies to define Russia's place in the world. Russia will define its own place in the world. And it's a place that is defined by the greatness of the sacrifice that the Russian people have made in making the Russian state what it is today. And Victory Day is a living manifestation of that sacrifice and the pride that the Russians have in those who sacrificed so that they can live at the present moment.
Zelensky's presidency is up on the 20th of May. Is his time coming close, do you think? I mean, nothing is going to be achieved. No negotiation is going to be achieved with Zelensky at the helm in an illegitimate presidential term. In fact, Russia's put him on the wanted list. What's your take on that?
Well, there's two, tells, so to speak. One, words mean everything to Russians, especially Russian leaders. And General or Marshal Shoigu, the defense minister, has recently said that Russia has gone over from the active defense to the offense. And this is more than just a military move. This signifies that Russia has made a decision that the time of negotiated settlement is over, and that Russia is now taking matters into its own hands to achieve a military-based victory premised on the notion of unconditional surrender. And what proves this point is the point you made. Russia has put Zelensky, Poroshenko, former president, and other senior members of the Zelensky government on a wanted list, which means that Russia will never negotiate with these people. Russia will never sit down at the table with these people. And that means that the opportunity for a negotiated end of this conflict is over. This conflict will be won by the sword, and that sword is going to be wielded in a bloody, effective manner by the Russians over the course of this summer.
Such a tragedy, such a disaster. Thank you very much, Scott Ritter, for your wisdom and eloquence, as always. Scott Ritter, former Marine Corps intelligence officer and world-renowned weapons inspector. The phone numbers again, US and Canada, +1-844-944-3344. UK and Ireland, 0808-196-5522, and the worldwide number, 44203-966-2625. After this quick break.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Lara El Bono is one of my favorite guests. She's a Palestinian-American international lawyer, activist, and co-host of the Palestine Pod. She's always welcome, but tonight it's even more important. Lara, welcome back to the show. I want to ask you as a lawyer first. I'll ask you as a Palestinian woman, how the invasion of Rafah, the crucifixion of the women and children there, long described as a red line for Western leaders, but which is now underway. How has that affected you and your community?
Thank you, George, for having me. You know, every day now for the last 7 months, we've been trying to come up with new adjectives to describe the situation and describe what Palestinians in Gaza are going through. And every day the situation gets worse and worse and worse. And I struggle to even find the words to describe you, to describe to you just how horrific, just how devastating, how apocalyptic, how torturous the situation is for Palestinians in Gaza right now, in Rafah. You have to keep in mind that these are people who have literally been displaced for the last 3-4 generations. In the last 7 months, they have been displaced by Israel multiple times, some upwards of 10, 11, 12 times. And each time they're being forcibly displaced, they're picking up everything that they have, and they're aimlessly walking in a panic to try to find safety. But of course, we know that there's absolutely no safety in Gaza, because everywhere that they have been told to go to find safety, they have been bombed along the way and bombed when they got there. And let's remember that Rafah is exactly the place that Israel told Palestinians to go to in October, when they first started issuing so-called evacuation orders, ordering Palestinians out of their homes so that their homes could be destroyed. And that's exactly what Israel did. Israel destroyed the majority of the homes and civilian infrastructure in Gaza in the last 7 months, kettled the majority of Palestinians into Rafah and told them that that's where they would be safe, when in reality, Israel has been bombing Rafah every single day for the last 7 months. And it's reached a point where now you have 2 days ago, the Israeli occupation forces have invaded Rafah with ground forces. And we've seen them installing their Israeli flags, using their tanks to run over an I Love Gaza sign at the Rafah crossing entrance, which we know is the only way for Palestinians out of Gaza, effectively sealing Palestinians into the death camp, which is Gaza. By so many people who are following this situation closely, it's been described as Israel implementing the final solution, to this Gaza genocide. And it's a deeply, deeply distressing moment. It's incumbent upon all of us to continue to do what we can every single day to stop the slaughter, to stop the starvation of the Palestinian people and this ongoing genocide.
Well, one struggles to avoid the term for obvious reasons, but it's increasingly difficult to avoid it. It is an attempt to finally solve the Israeli conundrum that they came and took a country, but failed to drive out all of the indigenous inhabitants of that country in the original Nakba. They drove out 800,000 people who have now become many millions, you among them, but they didn't quite succeed in driving out all of them. And so every day, the presence of Palestinians on the land that they stole is a standing reminder of the great crime that they committed. And they have sought so many ways and fought so many times to drive the Palestinian people from the land. They now control the gate which was previously controlled by Egypt. They can now open that gate and drive potentially all of the 1.6 million people, most of them women and children, through that gate into the Sinai Desert. Do you think that's what they're going to try and do?
Well, if we just go off of what Israel's been saying this entire time, very early on into this genocide, their ministers were very transparent. You had Israeli ministers saying that we are now rolling out the Gaza Nakba. You had various proposals that were circulated for the forced displacement of Palestinians, which I must remind is a crime against humanity, saying, oh, well, if we can just convince some Arab countries to take them, maybe we can convince the US and the EU to take the Palestinians. And these are actually policy discussions that were taking place in Israel, and they were not secret. They were happening also in media. Danny Dannon was writing op-eds talking about how Palestinians should just go abroad and we can have, you know, various countries take a certain number and we can just spread up all the Palestinians in Gaza amongst different countries. So this is their intention, according to their own words. And the facts on the ground reflect that that's exactly what they're pursuing. When you see the way that they've carried out this assault for the last 7 months, and they've destroyed absolutely every aspect of society that you need to survive, from all of the universities in Gaza to the almost entire healthcare infrastructure in Gaza, to the maintained starvation that is taking place as confirmed by the UN and as confirmed by all of the international organizations that are on the ground, to the destruction of nearly all of the infrastructure. The majority of the infrastructure in Gaza has been destroyed, and you have 2 million people who have lost their homes. So the point was to render Gaza unlivable. They have done that. People are barely holding on by trying to survive in tents, which have essentially turned into ovens due to the heat in Gaza at the moment. They spend all day looking for water. It's dirty when they find it. There's no sanitation. There's no safety anywhere because they continue to be bombed. And when they are and they become injured, there's nowhere to go to receive medical care. So you're talking about either quick annihilation or a slow and prolonged and torturous killing that Palestinians are now undergoing. And so these conditions, these circumstances that Israel has created for Palestinians on the ground is making it such that they are intending to leave Palestinians with no choice but to try to survive outside of Gaza. And we've already seen thousands of Palestinians pay the extortionary fees that Egypt, in coordination with Israel, has required of them to escape Gaza at the Rafah crossing over several months. Of course, that majority of Palestinians remain in Gaza, but some have been forcibly displaced. And of course, the great question is, will they ever be able to go back to their homes, or will this just be another chapter of Nakba in Palestinian history?
We'll come on to the future in a minute, but let me test you on the Camp David Accords, which forbid Israel to have forces in the Philadelphia corridor. They forbid Israel to control the frontier directly with Egypt. These Camp David Accords, which essentially form the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, were guaranteed by the United States government, hence the name Camp David Accords, 1979. Is anyone discussing this further egregious breach of international law in the U.S.?
George, we've been discussing Israel's violations of international law and its international obligations literally every day for the last 76 years. And we have been saying that we cannot let impunity reign. And yet, in every single instance, whether it's war crimes or crimes against humanity, or in this case, genocide, or how about before, when there was this consensus of Israel enacting an apartheid regime through the issuance of the reports of the major human rights organizations like Amnesty and Beit Salem and Human Rights Watch in 2021 and 2022, or how about the crime of aggression, or how about Israel's 56-year-long military occupation, which is currently before proceedings at the International Court of Justice on the legality of that occupation, because the international legal consensus is that the occupation occupation, given that it is now a permanent occupation, violates international law just in and of its existence. All of these crimes have been committed day after day after day for decades now. And there has never been any attempt to actually solve the underlying issue by getting Israel to comply with its international obligations and to actually pay reparations, allow the Palestinians their right, legal right to return, stop stealing Palestinian land, stop building settlements on Palestinian land, and enact the measures that would be required to reverse their violations of international law. What you've just mentioned is just a drop in the bucket of a culture of impunity, which is what has paved the way for this ongoing genocide, and which is what explains why Israeli soldiers, day after day, gleefully post their crimes onto social media. It's confirmation that they never expect to be held accountable for these crimes. So they'll film themselves firing a tank shell onto a Palestinian home and smiling, or saying, "We're going to burn this house," and laughing about it. And this is so dangerous, because what this does is not only does it is it just a stain on all of our conscience as humanity, but it creates very dangerous precedent going forward. Israel is changing international law through its violations of international law that are going unaddressed and making the world a more dangerous place to live in.
South Africa did, of course, take action. You and I discussed that at the time. The ICJ, the world's highest court, opined that Israel must immediately take certain steps, report back within 30 days. It's now at least 60 days, maybe 90 days. It's double or triple, at least, since that judgment was reached. The matter went for trial, speaking colloquially. What's happened to it? What's happened on it?
Well, at this stage, you have two orders that were rendered by the International Court of Justice ordering provisional measures, which Israel has blatantly ignored. Israel has pressed on with its genocidal campaign. And as we've discussed before, the court doesn't have any enforcement power. The enforcement rests rather with the UN Security Council, which did render a binding resolution ordering a ceasefire until the end of Ramadan, which, of course, Israel also ignored. And so what you have then is that it remains incumbent upon the people and upon the states to then seek to enforce these decisions. And I really believe that that's actually what we're seeing with the student encampments right now. They've seen that the law on its own has no potential to actually compel Israel to comply with its international obligations, and that it's on them to build power through a student movement in order to compel Israel to end its genocide, and also compel their governments and their institutions to cease funding and arming and being complicit in the genocide through their investments.
How are the encampments going, growing? Here in Britain, they are now spreading like wildfire. My own grandchildren, their campuses are now occupied all over the country. SOAS, London School of Economics, the University of London, and many, many others, Cambridge, Oxford. They are following the American example, a good example for a change. But the American encampment have been met with extreme brutality and sanction and punishment, right up to expulsion from the university, refusal to allow people to graduate, and so on. How is that going to affect the growth of that great popular movement?
Well, I think that at every step of the way, the repression by the universities and the militarized police in the U.S. Has only strengthened these movements. And I think we have to look at what these encampments are offering society and also what their demands are to understand why they are becoming so popular and why every day we're seeing more and more of them. These encampments are offering a different vision for society, a society based on mutual aid, helping one another, community education. We see libraries at these encampments. We see teach-ins. Their values are, promoting the interconnectedness of struggle, empathy, the rejection of endless wars, the rejection of genocide as a status quo. We also know that they have very sensible demands that are rooted in universal principles, humanity, and international law. Of course, their principal demands are to disclose and divest. So that means disclose where all of their tuition money is going and divest from the institutions and companies that are complicit or actively responsible in the mass killing of people in Gaza. Things like weapons manufacturers, tech and surveillance companies, and Israeli universities. The university administrators have no arguments to challenge their demands on the merits. And so instead, as you said, they have resorted to first collaborating with the militarized police to crush the students with brute force. I think now there's been over 2,200 arrests of students in the U.S. just in the last few weeks. And also, they've resorted to lying about their motivations. It's really insane. What possible argument could be brought against transparency, especially in these unprecedented circumstances of a live stream genocide? What possible argument could be made against divestment? Divestment is actually consistent with international law. The obligations to prevent genocide under the Genocide Convention, which we discussed, was reaffirmed by the ICJ's orders. It's consistent with the UN Human Rights Council's resolution, which was adopted in April, just like 2 weeks before the encampments began, demanding that all arms shipments to Israel cease. It's consistent with the report that was recently issued by an independent task force made up of former State Department officials and international law experts, which found that Israel uses U.S.-provided weapons to systematically attack civilians in violation of international law. It's consistent even with the recommendations from inside the State Department, which were entirely ignored by Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State, as revealed in the ProPublica report weeks ago around the time the encampments began, to sanction the Israeli military units that were linked to killing and rape of Palestinians. That's coming from within the State Department. So these are sensible demands, disclose and divest. But of course, neither the universities or the media are interested in having that discussion. So they lie and they say that these students are simply motivated by hate or anti-Semitism, which of course couldn't be further from the truth. It's so important to remind, not only is it not anti-Semitic to protest the actions of a state committing genocide, but there's no legal duty to protect the feelings of people who support genocide. And finally, we have to remember that Jewish anti-Zionist students form an integral part of those organizing these encampments and saying, not in my name. At the Columbia University encampment, for example, we saw a big banner that read Shabbat Shalom from the Gaza Solidarity encampment. But the mainstream media, of course, has completely erased their presence altogether because it doesn't suit their narrative. But I think we have to be very clear that if students are not safe on campus today across the United States, it's because those students, including Jewish students, are being beaten and arrested at the encampments with the consent of their university administrators. And that is really the problem here.
Well, I do hope these students are not going to go out and vote for Joe Biden in November. Lara Elborno, lawyer extraordinaire, Palestinian woman, Tribune of the highest rank. Thank you for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows this evening. A quick break, and then it's your calls.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Everyone's telling me what I should have known, of course, but a man of my age and class, how could I? Macklemore is the rap artist who's done the terrific new clip about Hind and Hind Hall with more than a hat tip to the wonderful Fairuz, who's more my kind of thing. Will Biden say stop, yes or no? Almost 30,000 now of you have voted. Let's get it to 30,000 in the next 10 minutes. Will Biden say stop, yes or no? Nick G says, George, you're one of the important few in the public domain that have spoken up and about this conflict in Gaza. For that, I say thank you and well done. Thank you, Nick. History always lies, says the biggest insult to the memory of the Holocaust is not denying it, but using it as an excuse to commit genocide against the Palestinian people, says Norman Finkelstein, the wonderful, wonderful Norman Finkelstein. Alan is in Liverpool, wants to talk about the British Army. Go ahead, Alan.
Hello, George. For a long time, I believe that the central defect in the British Army is that you can either be a superpower or you can be a regional power. But what you can't be is a mini superpower, which is what Britain has tried to do, and to a lesser extent, the French. And it used to be that the consequences of it were expensive, superfluous aircraft carriers, or perhaps an excessively large nuclear deterrent, or some other weapon system, which, you know, wasn't particularly relevant to our defence. And unfortunately, it's more serious now, because this delusion about our relative military importance is having consequences on real politics and real military deployments. You know, all this business with Cameron and Macron sending troops over, all the rest of it. So it's becoming really dangerous. So it really needs to be emphasised. I hope you have the opportunity to emphasise that. But also, one of the other problems, the big cost overruns. It should not be forgotten that the big cost overruns in the defence sector are due historically to basically privatisation of in-house technical expertise. Even the Americans were saying a long time ago that the amount of independent technical expertise in the RAF and the Navy was negligible. It's become absolutely ridiculous. And it's undoubtedly had something to do with these cost overruns. So that's another important point. Without a shadow of a doubt, defence is going to be a major theme in the election. I think we should be emphasising, yes, we will spend more money on defence, better barracks, better accommodation for soldiers, better training, possibly using the army in a training role, you know, with the unemployed, as well as modernise some of the essential systems. I personally have always been rather cynical about this. You need an army if that army could do something useful. There wasn't much point in Belgium and Holland and Luxembourg having armies in the Second World War for obvious reasons. They had no chance. It was going to be a conflict concerning major powers. I'm not really sure what Britain's role is, because, you know, the idea of sailing to the South China Seas or sailing into the Black Sea to confront the Russians or the Chinese is so ludicrous. You just have to laugh. What are we defending ourselves?
Well,
from?
You do. Yeah, I have to stop you only because of the hour and so many people trying to get on. But I actually think that's one of the best calls we've ever had. So it's not quality control, that's for sure. That's an outstandingly and well-informed contribution that you've made to the University of the Airwaves tonight. I am not a pacifist. I believe we have to have armed forces. I was a boy soldier in the armed forces. I almost became a Royal Marine in the grown-up forces. I attend all defense debates. I keep a close eye on military political affairs amongst the armed forces and across the world. And I wholeheartedly agree with many of the points that you made there. But we are now in the grip of a Dutch auction, where everyone is bidding to pay more than the other. The Tories are taunting Labour to agree to their demand to increase our defence expenditure to 2.5% of GDP, an increase of some £800 million, immediate increase. And growing right up to 2030. Labour will not confirm that they agree to it. You know why? Because when their election manifesto is announced, they will take the Conservative proposal and add more to it. That's why they're not agreeing to 2.5%. because they are going to run for office on a promise to spend 3% of our gross domestic product on military hardware, software, consultants, privatized bloodsuckers, on everything but poor Tommy Atkins, his poor pay, his poor living quarters. I mean, I only recently saw the married quarters of the British Army, and you wouldn't put a dog in some of those houses. Never mind expect a soldier and his family to live and grow up in. It is an absolute scandal that the two parties of the state are in the grip of exactly the same delusion. I said in a speech I gave on these matters in Parliament a month or so ago, look it up, I said that Mussolini used to go around the world threatening people with America's, Hitler's army. We are going around the world threatening people with America's army because our army is so small, it could all fit in to Villa Park. Short of a nuclear war, when, of course, we'd fire our nuclear missiles only for our entire island to be incinerated to ash. In response, we don't have an armed force. These popinjays, these pint-size popinjays, like Green, or whatever his name is today, the defense secretary, Shapps, like Cameron, the pig farmer. They know nothing about war, nothing about military affairs, but they're educated fools. They know that it's all a bluff, that if Putin wanted to, he could destroy them in a flash, in an instant. The only problem is we'd all be destroyed in the same flash, a nuclear flash, destroying 8 cities in the United Kingdom from a single rocket, 8 nuclear warheads, each 1,000 times more powerful than that dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You got my blood going now, Alan. I hope you'll call back another time to continue the discussion. Waleed Al-Yassi says, I'm a 50-year-old father, and I can't stop crying listening to your words without even looking at the screen. Waleed, I'm having difficulty with that myself. DW says, I'm all for those students. Just the same, a shame. Those same students worked with the authorities, worked so hard to narrow the Overton window to suit their own sensitivities for years. Dale, what would you like to say?
Hello, George. I'd like to dedicate this phone call to my nan, Jean. She was a long-time follower, supporter of you. She raised me. She used to read the Morning Star every week, so I was raised the right way. But my original call...
God bless her, Jean.
Thank you. Thank you. My original call, what I wanted to phone up to... just to inform you, if you didn't already know, is the Rwanda plan to send people to Rwanda, migrants, is originally an Israeli idea. In 2014, Israel was doing this, sending Palestinians in Gaza to Rwanda, because they have good relations with the president there, Paul Kagame, he's called. People can Google it. Yeah. Just Google Paul Kagame, Israel. They got stopped from doing it because apparently they were detaining people illegally until they agreed to do it. They got stopped, but they started doing it again. And I was just thinking maybe that's the reason why the pier's being built.
That's one of the reasons why the pier is being built, because it will be a huge embarrassment to the West to see hundreds of thousands of Palestinians streaming into the Sinai Desert. Better if they can be packed on board a ship on this pier that they are building. That will be less embarrassing, less atrocious an optic as the Sinai solution. That is one of the reasons. Rwanda and Israel are as close as can be, and they have one great friend in common. The one and only Tony Blair is at the same time a great friend of Israel and a great friend of Rwanda and its president for life. I don't know if you knew that, Dale. Kagame has been the president for, I think, at least 25 years and will be the president for at least another 15 years. He's a dictator. It's not a safe country. It's not a country that anybody other than Israel and Britain would ever send anybody to. And as for the Arsenal wearing their name on their football top, they should be ashamed of themselves. Dale, sorry I can't talk to you for longer. May God rest your lovely Jean. KPFK 90.7 FM across Los Angeles and Southern California from this Sunday's show will replay the show, and it will roll out across America if it is a success. Will Biden say stop? 30,427 people voted, and they voted overwhelmingly that Joe Biden will not say stop. And even if he did, the Israelis know that he doesn't really mean it. I'm going to look out for the Victory Day celebration in Moscow tomorrow, because it will cheer me up. It will remind me of when we defeated fascism, crushed the beast in Berlin under the boots of the victorious Red Army. It will remind me of better days when the USA, the UK, China, and the Soviet Union were brothers in arms, allies. If only we could turn the clock back, is what I say on so many things, if I'm being perfectly honest. We had a better country there. We had a better country, and we had a better world for a brief period in 1945 when the beast was beaten. It's been marvelous for me. I hope it was for you. If it was, come back on Sunday for the mother of all talk shows and bring another viewer with you. Why don't you? And don't forget to sign up to come on my show, Have It Out with Galloway.com.